Please welcome our speaker, Dr. Sharon Gwaltney Brandt. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to put this a little higher because I gather I wasn't talking loud enough before. It's usually not a problem with me, but my voice is giving out today for some reason. Okay, so we're going to talk about toxicology of common household hazards, and we like to subtitle this The Good, the Bad, and the Tasty. Okay, so pets eat the darndest thing. The lab encounter flowchart is sniff something. Is it edible? No. Just taste it. Do you barf? Yes. Sniff something else. If no, eat it. Is it edible? Yes. Eat it. That's the Labrador Retriever view of dealing with things in the environment, okay? So the good. These are the calls you want. You know, Friday afternoon, 5 minutes to closing. Someone rushes in the door with their pet. These are the ones you want to see because these are the ones you're going to be able to send out before you close, and you're not going to have too much of an issue with it, and it's not going to be haunting you through the weekend. Okay? The first are ant and roach baits. Once upon a time, ant and roach baits had some pretty icky things in them, like arsenic trioxide and mercury, and some even had thallium in them. Fortunately, most of those aren't used anymore, and so what we're dealing with now are active ingredients that have a much wider margin of safety in us mammals. Things like sulfuramide, fipronil, papoxir, boric acid, indoxacarbon, hydromethanon, these are the most common ingredients. These products are much more toxic to insects than they are to us mammals. They're in here at very low concentration, and they're really not going to cause too much of a problem. Boric acid-based ant baits can cause stomach upset, some pretty good vomiting, some stomach irritation, so an antiemetic and some GI protectants might be in order. But the others, really, the level that's in there is very low, so unless we have an animal, for example, with the hydromethanon baits, at the 0.87% that most of them are formulated at, you'd have to have a dog eat over 200 baits before they got even close to a toxic level, and that's a minimum toxic dose, and at that dose we'd expect vomiting. We wouldn't expect any systemic signs. So, again, these really aren't too much of an issue. The ones we need to watch out for, though, are the avermectin, chlorpyrifos, and arsenic ones. The arsenic trioxide, they haven't been manufactured in years, but they're still sitting on the shelves in some co-ops. They're still sitting under someone's cabinet. And if there's any bait left in there, there's still arsenic in there. And arsenic does not go away. It's a heavy metal. So if it's an arsenic trioxide one, we want to do a little more looking. Now, most of those arsenic trioxide ant baits, the amount that's in there is low enough that unless you're dealing with a very small dog, 20 pounds or less, you're not going to be dealing with too much of a problem. Larger dogs, we're not going to see a problem. With the smaller dogs, we could see some vomiting that could even be hemorrhagic. So we might want to decontaminate. Chlorpyrifos, I don't consider those an issue because they're generally 0.05% chlorpyrifos. However, there is an issue with cats being chronically exposed even to low levels of chlorpyrifos. Again, it's not usually the cats that are chewing on these baits, though. You still can't hear me? I'm sorry. Let me try this. I don't have a volume on this thing. Let me move it. Is that any better? Okay, I'll talk like this. I can do this. The avermectin-based baits aren't generally a problem. Avermectins are related to the nobilmycin, ivermectin, moxidectin, heartworm preventatives, okay? And they're generally not too much of an issue unless you get a small dog that eats a lot of them. If you get a small dog that eats 4 or 5 of these baits, we can get a dose of avermectin in there that could be equivalent to maybe 1 to 2 grams per kilogram of ivermectin, and then we might end up with some clinical signs. But a single bait, even in a fairly small dog, isn't going to be an issue with the avermectins. What these ant and roach baits primarily have in them are something along the lines of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for the ants and roaches. It's peanut butter, some kind of sweetener, jelly, sugar, honey, lard, breadcrumbs, basically something to attract the ants and roaches. And as we all know, dogs especially love the smell of peanut butter, so they will be attracted to these. So again, that's why they're going to go get them. But if they're ones that were recently bought and of the modern type, then we're not going to be too concerned about what's in them. But we do need to remember that plastic could pose a foreign body hazard if they swallow the trap whole or swallow big chunks of plastic. But again, in most cases, these aren't going to be an issue. Birth control pills. Now, these are your standard I don't want to get pregnant birth control pills, not hormone replacement pills, which can have varying levels of estrogen and progesterone in them. But our standard contraceptives contain 21 to 28 tablets. If they're 28, then 7 of those are placebos or sugar pills. Some of these may contain iron, and those are the ones we want to look at. The levels we're concerned about are, the ingredients we're concerned about, the estrogen, the progesterone, and the potential iron. The estrogen levels in most of these are 0.035 milligrams per tablet. There's not even a whole milligram in an entire month's worth, in other words. So we're not going to exceed that 1 milligram per kilogram point of concern with estrogen. Ditto with the progesterone. The progesterone is usually there 0.2 milligrams total per tablet. So we're not going to be getting close to the 10 milligrams per kilogram that we start worrying about progestogens. And then the iron, certainly if they're fortified with iron, we might have an issue if it's a small dog who eats a lot of the iron ones. But the majority of birth control pills out there actually don't contain iron. So usually these aren't an issue. But again, this plastic container can be ingested and we have a foreign body issue. Okay. So in order to get a milligram per kilogram, a 50-pound dog would have to eat 666 tablets on the regular standard standard birth control pill. So generally, again, we're not dealing with high levels of these hormones, and we're not going to see an issue. Silica gel and charcoal desiccants, these are the things that are put in the shoe boxes, the electronics. They're actually also in some the drug packaging, and they contain either silica or charcoal, both of which are basically considered biologically inert. So they're not going to be absorbed. They're not going to cause any systemic issues. Some of them are iron-based. Those we might get a little concerned about with the iron, but again, they're usually these teeny little packets, so the amount of iron is quite low. We may see some mild GI upset. There certainly is a foreign body potential if they're swallowed whole and it's a small dog. Again, these packets tend to be small. And then if it's a packet from a drug, I usually don't get too excited, but I want them to know what the drug is, because if it's something like Rumatrex, which is a methotrexate-based product, or something along the line that's really potent, I want to know, because I need to decide, is there a potential for the packet to adsorb enough of the drug for me to be concerned about? Most cases, the answer is no. Glojoroy can make you a hero in 5 minutes, because we do it every day on the poison control hotline. They call, they're hysterical, the animal is drooling and foaming and running around the house and hiding under the bed and freaking out, and oh my God, he's dying, he's got rabies, he's foaming at the mouth, and you can get that to stop in 5 minutes and make yourself quite a hero. Glojoroy, what makes them glow is the product called dibutyl phthalate. It is an extremely bitter and unpleasant tasting product. It's probably like handing someone a piece of candy that looks like chocolate and then biting into it and it being a jalapeno pepper instead. It's a tremendous sensory overstimulation, and cats especially will have a tremendously over-exaggerated response. They will drool excessively. They will run around the house. They can become aggressive. They become agitated. They shake their head, and then they go run under the bed. And so when I get a call like this on the poison control hotline, I say, open a can of tuna and shove it under the bed while we're talking. And they do that, and by the time we talk to them about this, is not anything life-threatening. Dibutyl phthalate is not terribly toxic. It's just really, really nasty, excessive taste reaction. They look under the bed, and the cat is happily eating the tuna, and we're in good shape. We do need to remember, though, once we get the taste reaction out by diluting with some type of food product or tuna juice or milk or whatever, just to get that taste out of the mouth, we do want to go ahead and take the animal in a darkened room and wipe any of the product off the coat. Because if they go to groom on themselves again and they get some more in their mouth, we're going to go through the whole scenario all over again. Not life-threatening, but these animals really, really get hysterical. And so do the owners. Soaps and non-ionic, anionic detergents. These are your bar soaps, your hand dishwashing liquids. Many, many household cleaners that when I was a kid were really, really toxic because they had a really high level of other types of detergents in them, or maybe lyes in them, nowadays aren't terribly, terribly toxic. They are good GI irritants. They will cause some vomiting, and they can cause some intense vomiting that may require some antiemetics and maybe even fluid therapy if the animal has been vomiting for a long period of time. But they're not corrosive. And our exception there is if it's a homemade soap with lye, but most homemade soaps these days are made with glycerin, so we don't have an issue. We don't really worry about systemic effects. They're not well absorbed. They basically clean the animal out one end or the other. So if they don't throw them up, they're going to have some loose stool coming out the other end. The other issue is a potential foreign body from this bar soap if they swallow it. Lever Brothers 2000 seems to be the favorite bar soap for dogs to get into. Don't ask me why. When they throw up, they will throw up bubbles out their nose. And that will again trigger a call into the veterinarian, because that is horrible. Oh, my God, my dog has bubbles coming out his nose. And it's like, okay, that's fine. He's all right. It's just bubbles from the soap. It'll be okay. Good symptomatic care. Antiemetics, fluids as needed, and generally you can get that vomiting under control. Yes, sir? Dishwashing soap for hand dishwashing soap. Dishwasher detergent is totally different. That's an alkaline corrosive agent. We're going to talk about that in a minute. So this is the hand dishwashing detergent like your Dawn, your Palmolive, your Joy. Super glues. They contain cyanoacrylate, and we all know we use cyanoacrylates as tissue glues as well, and or methyl methacrylate. Generally, they're going to end with acrylate. They harden quickly, so there's no absorption. There is an exothermic reaction while they're curing, so we can get mild thermal burns, very, very mild thermal burns, potentially. I'm not sure I've seen it. But we can glue eyelids or skin together, and probably some of the most guilty clients we get are the ones who pick up the tube of super glue thinking it's the eye ointment and put it in the animal's eye. And they feel so horrible, so awful. But again, that's our main issue. Did they glue anything together? If it's nothing's glued together, that dried glue is going to flake off. It's not toxic if they swallow it once it's dried. What we don't want to do is we don't want to pull any adhered parts together. Use lots and lots of water. Water will soften up the glue and allow the tissues to come apart naturally. If you have an eye that's been glued shut, have them soak the eye with put soaked gauze on the eye. Replace it every 20 minutes, and usually within 20 minutes to an hour, you can get the eye opened up. That eye generally will have an ulcer on it. It will need treatment, unfortunately. If it's skin contact and they really, really, really want to get it off, they can try some mineral oil, see if that'll loosen it up any better than the water. In most cases, you can tell them, don't worry so much about it. It will wear off without too much problem on its own. If it's in the mouth, again, let it wear away. If it's causing a lot of irritation, the dog's kind of flicking his tongue around because he doesn't like those flakes of glue on there, you can, again, try with vegetable oil. But most of the time, we just leave it alone, and within a short period of time, the saliva has softened it up enough that it comes loose. The residue is not toxic if it's swallowed, so if they groom it off themselves or swallow it from the tongue, it's not going to be an issue. Toilet bowl water. And this is from the tank drop-ins, the ones you put in the tank up there and then makes the bowl blue. Remember, your cats shouldn't drink blue toilet water because it's toxic. Well, that's back when they used methylene blue or other aniline dyes as their dyes. But the dyes they use nowadays are not the ones that can cause the oxidative damage to the red blood cells that we could see in the past. So mostly what we're dealing with is soapy water. Okay, so once it's dissolved in the water and the water's blue and the dog or cat drinks it, we can see some stomach upset just as we could if they got into any kind of other soapy thing. But again, it's not going to be a serious issue. The tubes, the gels, the tablets themselves, though, generally are somewhat alkaline. So if they actually get the actual tablet and chew on that, we could see some alkaline burns in the mouth. And we'll talk about the alkaline products here in a second. Okay, so those are the good. Those are the ones you want to hear about on Friday afternoon right before closing. Because most of those you're going to be able to get taken care of very, very quickly without too much of a problem. And I'm trying to put my mouth on here. So now we're going to talk about the bad, the things that can cause some pretty significant injury. And the first we're going to talk about are corrosive injury. And we have three different types of corrosives we're going to talk about: acids, alkalis, and cationic detergents. Acid products include some toilet bowl cleaners, some anti-rust compounds, most automotive batteries, many pool sanitizers. Pool chemicals in general are either acids, alkali, or cationic detergents. So pool chemicals in their concentrated form are generally considered pretty dangerous and should be kept out of the reach of pets. Acids produce an immediate coagulation necrosis of tissue, but they also cause immediate pain, so that often limits the exposure of the pet to that compound. Okay, they're going to feel the pain, they're going to spit it out and walk away because it hurts their mouth. That means we have less likelihood of esophageal damage with acid corrosive products. What do we expect to see? Well, we expect to see they're going to have oral pain. They may have some dysphagia. Certainly, if the exposure was severe enough and we got it down the esophagus and into the stomach, we could have pain or ulceration all the way down. Again, it's less common with the acid products because the animals generally restrict their exposure. If it's dermal contact, we're going to see ulceration or irritation. Ditto with the eyes. And many acid products are fairly volatile, so if we get a significant amount in the mouth, they inhale it down into their lungs, and we're going to see some respiratory and even perhaps some pulmonary irritation as well. What do we want to do with these? Well, first things we don't want to do is we do not want to neutralize. You put an acid, a strong acid and a strong base together, what do you get? Heat. You're going to get thermal burns on top of what you want. We don't want to do emesis or lavage. If it burned going back down, it's going to burn coming back up. and we don't want to administer activated charcoal. Activated charcoal does not adsorb these products, and I don't want activated charcoal in ulcerated mucosa. I don't want that nasty charcoal sitting in there interfering with wound healing. What do we want to do? We want to immediately dilute with water or milk. Get as much liquid down as possible. Try and wash everything down in the stomach where at least we have that gastric mucosa and mucus lining to helpfully prevent injury to the gastric mucosa. If we need to, sucralfate slurries for oral injury or esophageal injury. Pain medication is needed. Good supportive care if they've got a really nasty mouth going on because they've had a pretty nasty burn. We may need to consider some alternative way of getting them fed rather than orally. We may need to put a esophagostomy tube or a gastrostomy tube in. And then if we do want to watch and manage for esophageal burns and deal with those, and we'll talk about that when we get to alkaline corrosives where we tend to see more esophageal burns. If it's a dermal exposure, we want to flush the skin or ocular, flush with a good 15 minutes. Now, I'm not going to sit still for someone to flush my eye for 15 minutes at a time, so I don't expect my dog to, but I certainly can flush for 2 to 3 minutes, take a minute break, do it again, and just keep doing that. And then after that, go ahead and stain that eye and see if it needs any further treatment. And then respiratory signs. If we have significant evidence of respiratory exposure, initial coughing or retching or dyspnea, we need to hospitalize that animal and monitor for 24 hours because we can see a delayed onset of pulmonary edema, and it can take up to 24 hours to develop. So if there's initial indication that they actually inhaled some of it, they should be monitored very, very closely because we're going to get a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema as those alveolar cells die, shrivel up, and start leaking fluid into the lungs. Alkaline corrosives, these are our dishwasher detergents. These are our, things, the tablets we put in the dishwasher, the gels we put in the dishwasher, our drain openers. Most batteries, household batteries, are alkaline batteries. So when they chew the battery and get the black goo out of the middle, that's what we're dealing with. Some toilet bowl cleaners, especially the little tablets that you drop in the tank, the tablets themselves are alkaline. Again, once they're diluted, not an issue, but if they get into the tablet itself, could be an issue. Many swimming pool products, again, can be alkaline corrosives and some radiator flushes. Generally, if it has a pH of 11 or higher, it has the potential to cause ulceration. 10 or higher will cause irritation. 11 or higher will cause ulceration. What this causes is a very rapid penetrating liquefactive necrosis of tissue. And what happens is it basically anesthetizes the pain nerve endings for pain very, very quickly, so the initial pain is fairly minimal. The animal may not show any discomfort, and unfortunately what that does, it allows them to expose themselves far more than what we tend to see with acid products. Deep penetration of the tissue and certainly more potential for severe burns. These are ones where we don't see initially. Initially, the animal may seem fine. They'll call you and say, he just chewed this battery up. He's got black goo all over him, but he seems fine. He will for about 2 to 4 hours. And then the inflammation's going to start coming. He's going to start feeling worse and worse. I tell owners it's like getting a sunburn. You go out and get this sun exposure at 10 in the morning. It's not until 6 that evening that you feel the full extent of it. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here. The initial injury occurs immediately, but it's with the reaction with the inflammation that comes in that starts making them feel bad. So just because they're feeling fine now doesn't mean they're going to feel fine in 5 hours. What do we see? Similar signs as we did with the acids, except again, there might be delayed depression, oral pain, dysphagia, ulceration, vomiting, abdominal pain, melena. Hyperthermia, because of the intense inflammation that accompanies these types of burns, hyperthermia may be pronounced, especially in cats. These cats that get into your, it's a disinfectant, it's a cationic detergent, but they get into these, they'll come in with temperatures of 107 fairly easily. These are the ones we worry about esophageal ulceration because generally the exposure is much more significant than acids. And we also have some potential for inhalation injury, although these tend not to be as volatile as the acidic products, but certainly we can see some mild respiratory irritation. Again, just with acids, we don't want to neutralize, we don't want to attempt emesis lavage, and we don't want to administer activated charcoal. Same reasons for all of those. We don't want to produce an exothermic reaction. We don't want it burning coming back up. Even though we've got our lavage tube in, we're going to have reflux around that tube. We don't want to give activated charcoal if we're worried about eroded mucosa. And activated charcoal is not going to adsorb these. And again, with the alkaline corrosives, we're not worried about systemic effects. We're worried about local effects. Again, similar to the acids, we're going to dilute with water or milk. We're going to use sucralfate slurries as needed. pain medication, supportive care, and many times if we've got severe injury to the mouth, which is very common, or esophageal injury, which fortunately is less common, we may need to go ahead and consider putting in some alternative way of getting nutrition in that patient while the tissues heal. Esophageal burns, we generally recommend endoscopy to determine what degree of esophageal burns there are. We generally do not do that immediately. We wait at least 12 hours because in 12 hours we're going to know the full extent of the burns. If we scope them at 5 hours and don't see any significant burns, that doesn't mean we might not have some other burns developing in another 4 or 5 hours. So we generally wait 12 hours after exposure to evaluate the esophagus. If we have esophageal burns, sucralfate slurries, antibiotics, pain medication, the use of corticosteroids is controversial, depending on who you talk to. I think initially, if they're really febrile, an initial dose of dexamethasone is going to be beneficial in making them, dropping the body temperature, making them feel a lot better. It's certainly not going to interfere with wound healing as long as I don't continue to give it. Now, many people recommend with esophageal burns that you do give corticosteroids because they are going to decrease the fibrous tissue formation. However, they do also decrease wound healing and increase your risk of infection, and that's why, depending on who you talk to, some people will use them and some people will not. Complications, potential complications from esophageal burns, certainly perforation or stricture formation are two biggies that we're concerned about with these. Our third category of corrosive agents are our cationic detergents. These include our quaternary ammonium compounds that we all use to disinfect our practices. Those concentrated Rocal and products like that are cationic detergents. The cationics, I think of them as alkaline products, similar to alkaline products, but we can also see systemic effects as well. These are our disinfectants and sanitizers, our algicides, our liquid potpourris. Most of those are cationic detergents, and that's where most cats get into trouble. Some of our fabric softeners are cationics, and some are non-ionic anionic. You have to look at the label, and the label's usually, the degree of warning on the label can kind of clue you into which one it is. If it's something mild like may cause vomiting or keep out of reach of children, it's probably a non-ionic anionic. But if it tells you that harmful or fatal if swallowed can cause oral injury, then you're basically dealing with cationics. In the literature, it says if it's less than 2%, then we're not going to see corrosive injury, 2% per cationic detergent. However, we've seen corrosive injury at levels of 0.5% and above. So even if it's less than 2%, we have the potential for injury. Cats are very sensitive to these. They'll get in the potpourri. They'll groom it off themselves. These potpourris are 1% to 2% cationic detergents in most cases. They'll groom it off themselves, and then they have a big swollen tongue and a nice fever and a lot of injury. The local injury is just like the alkaline corrosive. The immediate injury, no pain, feeling fine, takes a while for them to develop. But in the differences, we can see systemic effects with significant exposures to cationic detergents. We can see some neurologic signs, such as depression, coma, or even seizures. We can see hypotension and pulmonary edema, a muscle weakness, fasciculations, and metabolic acidosis. In most cases, we don't know the mechanism of these, and many times this is why they present, or these initial these initial systemic signs, and then we see the burns coming up later. What do we do for these systemic signs? Well, we treat symptomatically. We manage any acid-base abnormality. We deal with seizures, usually with diazepam, fluids for good support, and then, of course, we manage our corrosive injury as best we can. Alcohols, ethanol, methanol, and isopropyl alcohol are the three we're going to talk about. That's my husband right there. Except it's, well, that's Bud Light. Okay. Ethanol from alcoholic beverages. Every year around Christmas time, we get tons of calls on dogs that have gotten into the eggnog, and, you know, the eggnog that was blessed with the brandy and drank the eggnog, or the white Russian that someone had sitting out on the thing. Dogs and cats generally will leave ethanol alone unless you mix it with milk. Once you mix it with milk, it's fair game, I guess. Many liquid medications, over-the-counter liquid medications, have fairly high levels of alcohol in them. And remember, dogs and cats are more sensitive than we are. So 13% ethanol in this over-the-counter cold medication, not only are we worried about the acetaminophen or whatever else might be in there, we're also worried about how much alcohol they got. Bread dough, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, about the ethanol produced by the yeast from bread dough. Methanol is in your windshield wiper, quote-unquote, antifreezes or windshield wiper cleaners. Okay? And isopropyl alcohol, that's rubbing alcohol. It's also present in alcohol-based flea sprays. And people can douse a cat with an alcohol-based flea spray and cause an alcohol toxicosis because it is well-absorbed dermally. Rapid oral absorption, rapidly absorbed by inhalation, and rapid dermal absorption as well. Like all alcohols, when you and I go out and drink a beer, we feel it within 30 to 60 minutes. If 60 minutes have passed and the animal was exposed 60 minutes ago and he's not showing any signs, he's not going to. We're going to see those signs sooner rather than later. What do we expect to see? Well, they're irritants to the stomach, so we tend to see vomiting, drooling because they're nauseated, and then we see our inebriation. They're ataxic, they're disoriented, they may show tremors. Severe cases may become hypothermic, comatose. Those comatose animals may seizure. We can also see aspiration pneumonia and respiratory depression. When we see deaths from alcohol toxicosis, it's usually due to respiratory failure, hypothermia, hypoglycemia, or acidosis. Methanol causes blindness and neuronal necrosis in primates and especially humans. There are going to be huge warnings on these windshield wiper fluid bottles about can cause blindness or death. People will read that and they'll be all freaked out, and then they'll call a human poison control center who will say, oh yes, you got to get them in and got to get them treated. It's not going to happen in non-primates. Non-primates handle methanol differently, and the difference in metabolism means that all we're going to see with methanol in our dogs and cats is the drunkenness that we expect from any other alcohol. You do not need to worry about the blindness or the neuronal necrosis. So what we deal with is alcohol. We do not worry about the problem that we can see in people. Because absorption is so rapid, decontamination has to be done quickly. If you haven't done emesis within the first 30 minutes, you're probably not going to get much back because it's probably pretty much absorbed. Activated charcoal is kind of controversial. Activated charcoal isn't thought to pick up small alcohols. I don't generally recommend activated charcoal with alcohol ingestion. And then if it's a dermal exposure, we certainly want to bathe them off. If we have a symptomatic animal, pushing a diuresis is going to enhance the elimination of the parent compound in the urine. All the alcohols are eliminated as parent compound in the urine. They're also metabolized to metabolites that are eliminated in the urine. The faster we can get the urine going out, the more we can get rid of that parent compound and get it out of the system. Yes, ma'am. I did not hear everything. The bladder was huge and...
I had a chocolate toxicosis on Monday.
Okay.
Wasn't eating.
Okay.
Well, she's been absorbing the toxins from the urine.
The question was, can some of the toxins from chocolate be absorbed across the urine? Caffeine is the component that can be reabsorbed across the urine. That's across the bladder wall. And that's why with chocolate toxicosis, which we'll talk about in a minute, we do recommend catheterization or frequent voiding. Alcohol is usually not reabsorbed across the bladder wall, and generally these animals are tremendously polyuric anyway. So as long as they're peeing or we got a catheter in place, we're usually in pretty good shape. We want to provide thermoregulation. If they're comatose, they're going to get cold. Respiratory support is needed. Correct an acid-base imbalance or hypoglycemia is needed. These animals can become quite hypoglycemic. If they're seizuring, we can use diazepam, but use as low a dose as possible because once you get the seizure under control, they're going to go back into that CNS depression, so we don't want to put too much diazepam in them and compound that CNS depression. When we have a situation, we have a severely comatose animal who's in respiratory distress and we feel we're going to lose them, yohimbine has been used anecdotally to treat life-threatening CNS depression. I will tell you, though, that the overt or excessive use of yohimbine runs the risk of inducing seizures. So we usually only use it when we feel we're going to have an animal in respiratory arrest. In most cases, just like you and me, full recovery within 24 to 36 hours after imbibing on the alcohol. Batteries. We have our automotive batteries, which are very uncommon exposure. These are acid-based. The other types of batteries, pretty much anything else in the house is going to be an alkaline-based battery. And these are the ones we're going to talk about. For our alkaline-based batteries, we basically risk esophageal mucosal and esophageal ulcers if they're punctured. And we also run the risk of foreign body obstruction. A GI foreign body, depending on the size of the animal and the size of the battery. So these disc batteries can be inhaled into the trachea where they pose a respiratory foreign body. One of the saddest calls we had on the Poison Control Center hotline was a little 13-year-old boy who was home alone and his kitten inhaled one of his hearing aid battery. And he was basically suffocating over the phone, and one of our doctors was trying to do whatever she could to try and help him dislodge the battery. Unfortunately, the kitten's mouth had clenched shut, and the poor kitty died while we were on the phone. It was very, very sad. When they swallow these disc batteries, they tend to lodge in the esophagus. They like to lodge just before the entrance to the stomach. And when they do that, the mucosa will fall down on either side of the battery. There will be a current generated, and we can get perfectly round ulcers develop on either side of the battery. What's been shown experimentally is that if you use bolus as a tap water, you can interrupt that current and prevent that mucosal damage. So if you have a dog that has ingested a button battery, and the owners have called you, have them go ahead and bolus the dog with water while they bring it into the clinic, and then you can radiograph it. If it's sitting in the stomach, and again, depending on the size of the dog, once it's sitting in the stomach, it's generally not thought to be too much of an issue. You can bulk up the diet and pass it on through. If it's still sitting in the esophagus, then we need to do something to get it down in the stomach or to bring it back up, one of the two. And again, if they puncture it and get the alkaline material out, well, fortunately, these have only teeny tiny amounts of alkaline material in them because they're so small, the burns are probably going to be fairly minimal. What do we do with ingested battery casings? We have a dog that we know for sure swallowed a battery. We know he didn't puncture it. We're not worried about wounds. What do we do with this casing? Well, what's in these casings? You know what? The manufacturers don't even know, because I went around and called Duracell and Rayovac and all these different manufacturers. They order their casings from overseas. They have no idea what's in them. Some kind of metals. That's all they know. So we don't know if there are heavy metals in there that are going to be a problem if they sit in the digestive tract for any length of time. So I don't feel comfortable with the battery sitting in the stomach for more than 2 to 3 days, because I'm worried, is there lead in there? Is there mercury in there? Is there some other metal, zinc in there that I'm worried about? Small batteries often will pass on their own if you just bulk up the diet pretty good. Metamucil, boiled white rice, bread, whatever you like as a bulking agent. And you can verify their location by radiography and see that it's coming out. Have the owners watch for 48 hours for it in the stool. If it hasn't shown up, then bring them in, have them radiographed, and see where the battery is. With large batteries, if we know for sure the casing has not been breached, we can certainly go ahead and try and make them throw up the battery or go in endoscopically and remove it. We don't want to do either of those things if we know they've been chewed, because that material leaking out of it is going to leak up as you're pulling it out through the esophagus or as the animal's throwing up, and we could end up with esophageal ulcerations. So large batteries that have been punctured probably are going to most safely be removed via surgery. There are two main variety of mothballs out there, the naphthalene and the paradichlorobenzene. The naphthalene are by far the more dangerous. Paradichlorobenzene, they say it's half as toxic as naphthalene. I think it's probably down a few more grades than half, but certainly it's the naphthalene that we're most concerned about. These can cause Heinz body hemolytic anemia with and without methemoglobinemia. And if we figure an average mothball, naphthalene mothball, is anywhere from 2.5 to 3.5 grams, the 2.7 gram mothball is going to contain 2,700 milligrams of naphthalene. And when we know that we see hemolysis in dogs at about 400 milligrams per kilogram or 411 milligrams per kilogram, that comes out to about a mothball per 15 pounds. And cats are at least twice as sensitive as dogs. They have far more sulfhydryl groups on their hemoglobin that can react with this highly reactive naphthalene and induce methemoglobin. So they're going to be a lot more susceptible. So it's going to take even less than that in the cat to be an issue. And what do we see? We see Heinz body hemolytic anemia. So they're going to present weak with chocolate-colored mucous membranes, icterus, evidence of hemolysis, and or methemoglobinemia. Paradichlorobenzene, much, much less toxic. This is actually an organochlorine. What we tend to see is vomiting and drooling. What we can see with really large ingestions are some mild neurologic signs like disorientation and ataxia. And there may be some changes in the liver values. Overt liver failure is not expected. It's less likely to see any really severe life-threatening signs with these. With the mothballs in general, we do want to do early decontamination, emesis, charcoal, and cathartic. Another one where charcoal is thought, the naphthalene is a fairly small molecule, may not pick it up, but certainly it's something to think of. Manage any hemolytic anemia as needed. And then manage hepatic injury. Again, almost never an issue with paradichlorobenzene. It's in the literature for both human and veterinary medicine with paradichlorobenzene. Manage liver injury. Well, yeah, their liver enzymes go up, but they go right back down with or without any specific treatment, and we never see any overt evidence of liver failure. Pennies. Pennies minted since 1982, 1983 are 99% zinc. They're just covered by a very thin veneer of copper. Also, some pennies from the 1940s may contain zinc. So if the dog gets into the penny collection and gets some very old pennies, we may see an issue. Other potential causes of zinc include certain carpentry hardware, such as nuts and bolts, galvanized metals, and zinc oxide-containing ointments. The nice thing about the ointments is if they ingest it all at once, those zinc oxide-containing ointments are so irritating, they usually decontaminate themselves before we get enough zinc to be a problem. But if they don't throw it up or if they ingest it over a period of several days, such as someone is slathering it on the animal and they're routinely licking it off, we can see an issue with that as well. That is actually not a penny. That is actually a Pepto-Bismol tablet. Just to remind you that not everything that glows and is round is a coin. But Pepto-Bismol tablets will look like coins in the stomach. The penny gets in the stomach, and the stomach acids leach off that copper veneer and get to the zinc underneath, and the zinc is ionized and gets absorbed, and it's basically causes acute intravascular hemolysis. How long does this take? Well, it really is highly dependent on the individual, so we can't say. I would never let a penny sit in the stomach more than 24 hours before I did something about it. Generally, if you talk to people, generally these animals present acutely collapsed because of their hemolysis, but if you talk to the owners, and they will mention that maybe there have been some anorexia or mild vomiting for the last few days because the zinc is irritating to the stomach lining, and once it starts being exposed, we usually do see some mild GI signs, but oftentimes it's not enough for owners to seek veterinary care. It's not until they collapse from the hemolysis that we have an issue. We can see secondary renal failure with these guys. And certainly you can run zinc levels. However, with the turnaround time, it's not going to help you in acute toxicosis. You're going to get the levels back a couple days from now. The animal will either be dead or recovered. So how do we manage these? If we know there's a penny in there, we can try and induce vomiting. If the copper isn't completely eroded off, usually they throw them up pretty well. Once the copper's eroded off, those pennies actually kind of like to sink into and stick to the rugae of the stomach, and they don't come out quite as well. We can certainly remove them by endoscopy or by surgery, and we can verify that with radiography. Anytime you remove them, you want to take them back and make sure you got it all out, because sometimes you'll lose pieces, especially if they're badly eroded. One thing to remember is that you might have a pet that has presented for vomiting. You radiograph him, you see the coins in there, you go in, you remove them either via endoscopy or surgery, and 2 hours later they hemolyze. They were going to hemolyze anyway. Yes, it still can happen. They're still not out of the woods. Give them at least a good 12 hours after surgery before you stop monitoring them for hemolysis, because sometimes they will hemolyze even after you've gotten the pennies out. And again, remember, they were going to hemolyze. You didn't do anything bad to the dog by going in there and getting it. It's just that now you took it out while the animal was stable. Now we just have to deal with the hemolysis. We deal with the hemolysis by transfusions as needed. Fluids, again, we want to keep them well hydrated to maintain the integrity of the kidneys while the fluid diuresis, or while the zinc is being eliminated. Supportive care, and we almost never, ever recommend chelation for two reasons. It's been shown that the zinc levels will drop precipitously in the first 24 hours once the source is removed. If the zinc levels are not dropping, it means you have renal insufficiency. The chelate you're putting in there, the chelator for zinc is nephrotoxic. So if I already have renal insufficiency, do I want to put a nephrotoxic chelator in this animal? I'm thinking no. Most of the time, these animals, their zinc levels are going to drop like a rock once you get the source out, and they're not going to need chelation. So we do not generally recommend chelation with zinc, or with pennies, I should say. Okay, paintballs, those of you who were here excuse me, in the previous hour, we did a little case study on paintballs. These are used for those war games. They contain paints within a gelatin capsule, and large ingestions have been associated with acid-base imbalances, electrolyte disturbances, neurologic signs, and occasionally death. Our main issue is our hypernatremia with our rapid acute rise in sodium level following the ingestion of the paintballs. Most of these are labeled non-toxic. That's because there's nothing in there that's going to be absorbed that's going to cause a systemic problem. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to have problems with them, because what we're dealing with are highly osmotic ingredients that are pulling free body water into the gut and causing a basically hemoconcentration and a relative hypernatremia in the rest in the vasculature, and basically we end up with hypernatremia. Common ingredients: polyethylene glycol, high molecular weight, glycerol or glycerin, sorbitol, dipropylene glycol, mineral oil, ground pig skin, a gelatin, dye, and water. Dogs are very attracted to these. They cannot eat just one. They tend to eat the whole container. Polyethylene glycol, the low molecular products are very toxic, are fairly toxic if they're because they are absorbed systemically, but those are not what are in the paint balls. What's in the paint balls are the high molecular weight products that draw water into the gut. And if anybody's had a colonoscopy and you've taken the Go Lightly or the New Lightly, that's what's drawing all the water into your gut is the polyethylene high molecular weight polyethylene glycol that's in there. Glycerol also has some cathartic effect, as does sorbitol. Gelatin also may contribute, although probably minimal. Dipropylene glycol is absorbed, but it's metabolized to propylene glycol. High enough doses, we can get basically an alcohol intoxication, acidosis, CNS depression, but we don't expect liver or hepatic injury. Mineral oil provides a laxative effect. So what do we see? We expect to see vomiting, ataxia, disorientation, muscle fasciculation, tremors, diarrhea, and seizures. Generally, these signs develop within 1 to 3 hours of ingestion. And we can have some pretty high sodium levels reported. Acidosis is also common, so that means we need to, differentiate ethylene glycol toxicosis. What do we do with these guys? Well, if we have an asymptomatic animal that's gotten more than 5 paint balls per pound, we consider an emesis. We could certainly consider a lavage if we have a massive exposure. We don't use activated charcoal. It actually, the sorbitol and glycerol and the activated charcoal formulations can exacerbate the signs that we're seeing because they're going to draw more water in. And it's not because they're absorbing anything that's causing the issue here. It's because everything's staying in the gut, so the activated charcoal is not needed. And then we're going to monitor 4 to 6 hours for development of any clinical signs. If we get a very rapid rise in sodium, we can also drop it rapidly within the first 24 hours. After 24 hours, we're getting into more of a chronic hypernatremia. We don't want to be dropping it that rapidly. We can use dextrose and water. We can use half normal saline. Water enemas work really, really well on these guys. I highly recommend them in addition to your IV fluid therapy to go with the water enemas. I usually use about 50 mils per 10 pounds. Monitor for acidosis. Generally, if we correct the sodium, the acidosis goes away on its own. So I generally tell them this is the last thing I treat. If they're still acidotic and the sodium's looking in the normal range, then we can probably give some bicarb. And maybe that acidosis is due to some of the propylene glycol. And then we're going to control seizures. Valium usually works fairly well. And oh, by the way, your ethylene glycol test is going to come up positive because the polyethylene glycol, glycerol, and dipropylene glycol all can contribute to give you a false positive on your ethylene glycol test. So if you're concerned that ethylene glycol is also a possibility, you probably want to send a sample over to a human hospital whose lab can then differentiate between these products and ethylene glycol. Okay. Polyurethane adhesives. These are expanding wood glues. Gorilla Glue is probably the one most people are familiar with, but also Elmer's makes a product. There are a variety of other products on the market. They're all expanding wood glues. There's also some expanding insulation foams that can also cause similar problems. They all have isocyanates or diisocyanates in them. They produce large gastric foreign bodies requiring surgical intervention. And don't confuse these with super glues. These are different. And a list of our common diisocyanates, I believe, is in your notes. Primarily a problem when the bottles are chewed. Licking it up off the floor, eating the paper towels generally hasn't caused anything more than stomach upset. But definitely when they've chewed the bottles, there have been an issue. This is one we tried to dilute with food. As if you were here in the previous hour, you saw that nice, round, perfectly round cast. This one's irregular because it's got food mixed in with it. So this is 2 ounces of glue plus a little bit of food. This is one of our first cases. We thought, well, if we dilute it with food, it won't make a foreign body. Well, yeah, it does. It just makes a bigger foreign body with food in it. Okay? So we're peeling away the gastric mucosa. And if you look at that mucosa, it looks a little red and angry. And this one was very, very friable because it had the food in it, and they were plucking out bits of glue. And there's your 2 ounces of glue plus a little bit of food. And see the breed? Notice the breed there? Okay. So what do we do with these? These can be challenging because do we want to induce vomiting? Do we want to risk some of that glue lodging in the esophagus and forming an expanding foreign body in the esophagus? I think no. Again, attempts to dilute it food have not been very successful. And certainly if we add water or milk or something like that, we're just adding fuel for the fire because these things expand by pulling water in from the environment. So if we're putting more water down the stomach, we're providing even more substrate for it to expand with. Activated charcoal, again, not advised. It's not anything we're they're absorbing that's going to be an issue. It's the fact we've got this big old foreign body in their stomach. So what we generally do is have them monitor, and if we do end up with some retching, we usually send them in about 2 hours later for a radiograph to see if there's evidence of a foreign body, and oftentimes we'll look what they call like a belly full of kibble. And then, again, large foreign bodies may require surgical removal. We've had a few that have developed small, multiple foreign bodies that have passed out in the stool without any problem, but most of them end up with the large foreign bodies. And this is an example. You can see the stomach distended, and that's all super glue in there, or Gorilla Glue in there. Okay. Now we get into the tasty bread dough. This is our raw yeast dough, and when the yeast in the process of going through their metabolic process produce not only the carbon dioxide that allows for the expansion of the bread dough, but also they produce a significant amount of ethanol. So not only do we have an animal with a gastric distension, we have an animal that has the potential to be inebriated. So we may or may not see vomiting attempts as that expanding mass is in the stomach and it's not coming up. We can see abdominal distension, we can see depression, and then as the alcohol kicks in, we can see ataxia, inebriation, acidosis, recumbency. And certainly if we have a large enough expansion, we can end up with vascular compromise to the gastric wall. And certainly if, again, large enough expansion, we can have respiratory compromise from abdominal distension. We had a little, like, 20-pound Pekingese that ate five roll cinnamon bun type things before they went in the oven. And he was having significant respiratory difficulty. He was very, very distended. What do we want to do with these? Well, first thing we try is a cold water gastric lavage. The cold water will shut down the yeast. Any of you tried to make bread know that yeast get cold, they get mad, and they stop reproducing. Now, this can compound our hypothermia, so we need to be a little careful, but the reality is we need to shut those yeast down. We certainly can try to use the lavage to bring up the dough, but if there's a large wad of dough in there and it's not coming out on its own, it's not passing, we may need a gastrotomy. And then we manage our alcohol toxicosis just like we did earlier, fluids, supportive care, corrected acid base and glucose problems, and good thermoregulation. Chocolate? Toxicosis is most common around the holidays, Christmas, Valentine's Day, Easter, Halloween. I'm missing one. But anytime people give chocolates, that's when we're going to see it, or eat chocolates. And if you look at from 2005, December is our big month for chocolate intoxication, based on the Poison Control Center. Sources, candies, cakes, brownies, cooking ingredients. Unsweetened cocoa is the most potent chocolate out there. The more diluted it is, the more stuff it's got in there. If it's got fat in it, that's taking place of some of the cocoa. So basically, unsweetened cocoa, unsweetened baking chocolate are our most toxic. Cocoa bean mulches can have pretty significant amounts of methylxanthines in them as well. Our primary toxic principles are theobromine and caffeine, and these amounts are going to vary. It's a plant product; they're going to vary based on growing season and all that. But we have averages that we can use to calculate doses, and then you have a table in your notes on this, but look, notice white chocolate, which has virtually no cocoa in it, has virtually no methylxanthines in it, all the way down to our unsweetened cocoa powder with about 800 milligrams of methylxanthines per ounce. And then our cocoa bean mulches, that number is an estimate based on analysis that we can look at. And then we remember our co-ingestion, chocolate-covered raisins. Okay, we're going to also worry about our raisins. Chocolate-covered macadamia nuts, we're going to worry about our macadamia nuts too. Chocolate-covered coffee beans, more caffeine, oh boy. Alcohol and chocolate bottles, we got those little bottles filled with the alcohol, the liqueurs. We have alcohol to be concerned about. Our marijuana brownies, marijuana to be worried about. And our chocolate-covered magic mushrooms. Believe it or not, we have two times a year that we get calls on chocolate-covered or magic mushrooms in general. Can anyone guess what they are? Halloween. Christmas. People are giving them as gifts. So they dip them in the chocolate, they put them on the wax paper to dry, and then the dog gets up on the table and eats them. So those are our two holidays that we see them most commonly. With our methylxanthine toxicosis, LD50s of caffeine and methylxanthine in dogs ranges from 100 to 300 milligrams per kilogram. In many references, this is listed as a minimum toxic dose. This is actually the LD50, and that means half of them are dead. So it's a big difference, but some references have misquoted the minimum toxic dose. Per our experience, and obviously there are a tremendous amount of individual variations in response to caffeine and theobromine, but our experience is that about 20 milligrams per kilogram of total methylxanthine, we can start seeing mild signs, vomiting, polyuria, polydipsia, mild restlessness. At about 40 to 50 milligrams per kilogram, those signs are going to be more pronounced. We're going to see agitation, and we can start seeing cardiotoxic effects, so we can start seeing cardiac arrhythmias. At about 60 milligrams per kilogram, we can start seeing seizures. So obviously, we can see some pretty nasty effects well below those levels that are listed in some references as minimum toxic doses. So we're a little more careful with chocolate. What we see with methylxanthines is they cause significant cardiovascular and CNS stimulation. Because chocolate, when they eat large amounts of chocolate, it could form a little wad in the stomach that can take a while to leach out enough methylxanthine, we can sometimes see a delay in signs up to 12 hours. We also can induce emesis up to about 8 or 12 hours because sometimes that chocolate sits in the stomach for a while. Initial signs, polydipsia, bloating, vomiting, diarrhea, mild restlessness. More severe signs, hyperactivity, polyuria, ataxia, rigidity, tremors, arrhythmias, hyperthermia, seizures, coma, death generally due to cardiac arrhythmias, respiratory failure, or DIC due to hyperthermia. Why is it always the white dogs, you know? Decontamination, again, emesis is often successful up to several hours after ingestion. And activated charcoal in this case is very important because of the intrahepatic recirculation that the theobromine undergoes. We can interrupt that by giving multiple doses. However, we do want to watch for those fluid shifts in the hypernatremia, so let's monitor the sodium levels on these guys. Fluid diuresis, again, to enhance the elimination. Caffeine is eliminated unchanged in the urine. If we can push the fluids on them, we can get the caffeine out. We do want to use the urinary catheter because, as we mentioned earlier, the caffeine can be reabsorbed across the bladder wall. So if we can catheterize these animals or at least encourage frequent voiding, we can get the caffeine out of the system quicker. Managing arrhythmias, propranolol, metoprolol for usually what we're dealing with are tachyarrhythmias. Seizure control, most of the time they are responsive to diazepam. Tremor control, methocarbamol works really well. Methocarbamol and diazepam make a nice couple with chocolate toxicosis. Thermoregulation, again, they tend to come in fairly hot. We want to get their body temperature down. Usually getting the tremors under control can help that out quite a bit. We're going to monitor our electrolytes, EKG, and acid base. And again, remember, in a significant toxicosis, signs can persist up to 72 hours. And because it's a nice dietary indiscretion, pancreatitis is something to be concerned about. Okay, our food molds, moldy food. This came out of the fridge at the center. Tremorgenic mycotoxins, I think this is probably one of those underdiagnosed toxicoses we have because people just think it's associated with moldy dairy products, but the reality is any moldy food, any moldy product, that moldy roadkill sitting in the middle of the road, any of those can have tremorgenic mycotoxins on them. There are a tremendous number of tremorgens out there produced by a tremendous number of fungi, but the clinical syndrome is virtually identical, so we don't need to worry about all their different names. The mechanism is generally similar to the mechanism of strychnine toxicosis. And what do we see? We see fine muscle tremors that gradually progress to more coarse tremors, and probably convulsions is a better word than seizures since there's very little central activity. Could also see vomiting, hyperactivity, depression, tachycardia. Death, if they die, generally they die within 2 to 4 hours due to respiratory compromise, acidosis, or hyperthermia. In these cases, early decontamination is important. We want to go emesis, activated charcoal with a cathartic. But again, we do want to manage our tremors first in these symptomatic animals. And methocarbamol is the drug of choice for these guys. You can also add it Valium if they're hyperesthetic. Generally works fairly well. Fluids for good supportive care and thermoregulation. If there are any acid-based or electrolyte abnormalities, we want to fix those. And again, severely hyperthermic animals may be at risk for DIC, so we want to monitor that. And if there's an interest in whether or not this was indeed a tremorgen, the stomach contents, vomitus, any suspected foods can be analyzed for the various tremorgens. These cases are generally, if we catch them early, the prognosis is quite good. These animals may They respond very well to your initial therapy. However, mild signs may persist for up to several days or weeks, mild kind of intention-type tremors that gradually reside. And again, another dietary indiscretion, so we keep in the back of our mind, possibly a pancreatitis. Grapes and raisins. Remember that one grape is equal to one raisin, but there are four and a half times as many raisins per ounce than grapes. Our lowest dose associated with renal failure is 0.7 ounce per kilogram. Anything more than 1 to 2 grapes should be considered as potentially significant exposure. Dogs, possibly cats, possibly ferrets. Don't know the mechanism, but we do know it causes proximal tubular necrosis. Well, we see generally vomiting, lethargy, diarrhea in the first 12 hours. We can see ataxia, abdominal pain within 24 to 48 hours. How do we treat these guys? Initially, we induce vomiting. We give activated charcoal. We do recommend a 48-hour fluid diuresis. And then if at the end of that time the renal values are normal, we can wean off fluids. The renal values go up. We maintain them on fluids until the renal values have returned to normal. Symptomatic care for everything else. Last one, xylitol, real quickly. So it's sugar alcohol. It's in people, large ingestions cause diarrhea, intestinal cramping, and hypernatremia. It's used in sugar-free products such as sugar-free gums and mints, and because it can handle baking, it can be in sugar-free baked goods. In people, it doesn't significantly alter the blood glucose, and it doesn't stimulate insulin secretion. And so when we have overdoses in people, we just expect the GI signs. However, in dogs, it doesn't raise blood glucose, but it does cause a large release of insulin, and that results in severe hypoglycemia. And in large ingestions, we've also seen liver failure. The exact mechanism of the liver failure isn't known. And so, again, notice that xylitol in dogs causes a tremendous release of insulin. Clinical signs, vomiting, weakness, ataxia, seizures, hypoglycemia, hypokalemia, often within 15 to 30 minutes. And if we have an asymptomatic animal that's ingested, say, sugar-free gum, we want to induce emesis. Activated charcoal is probably not going to be very good. It's a small molecule. We can certainly add feedings with added sugar. Symptomatic animals, we want to give a bolus of dextrose and then follow that with a CRI. Small, frequent meals. We may need to substitute potassium. And the hypoglycemia can last for quite some time. We do want to watch liver values, especially with large ingestions of xylitol. We see elevations in ALT, alkaphos, and AST. We can end up with coagulopathies and hyperbilirubinemia. And of 7 dogs that developed liver failure within 48 hours, 5 died, 2 recovered, and the necropsy was severe liver necrosis. And we don't know the mechanism of liver injury. Some of these dogs actually did not show any initial hypoglycemia or signs of hypoglycemia. They presented with their liver failure, but no one mentioned any fact that they were weak or seizuring or anything earlier on. And certainly if we have a large ingestion, we may want to put them on liver protectants. Okay, and I think I'm out of time, so I'm going to let it go. Any questions? Yes? The question was, any reports of problems with xylitol in cats? We do not have any information on that, and the studies that were done in dogs to show the effects of xylitol and insulin secretion were done in the 50s. And they did it on a variety of species, but cats was not one of them. So we do not know whether xylitol is an issue for cats or not. Any other questions? Yes?
How much macadamia nuts or garlic?
Did I have it in there? What do we decide about... With the macadamia nuts, it came out to like a nut per kilogram. One average macadamia nut, which is about 3 grams per kilogram, can show signs. Garlic, of the raw garlic, the toxic dose is considered 5 grams per kilogram. Our biggest issue with garlic and onions, though, is not the actual raw product, but the powder, the garlic powder and the onion powder. Because in an onion soup mix, the amount of onion powder in there is the equivalent of something like 10 grams of onions or something. So it's a tremendous amount of... So it's usually the powdered products that are problems with that. Even dogs won't eat that much garlic or onions usually. Any other questions? Yes, sir. White chocolate has virtually no methylxanthines in it, so it is not considered toxic. It's got a lot of fat and sugar in it, though. Okay? Thank you.